Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Yourself a cup of Jawa juice and sit down for Aggressive Negotiations, the Star Wars podcast here on the Nerd Party Network that concerns itself with Star Wars and only Star Wars, but more importantly, the remote corners of the Star Wars galaxy, the philosophical depths found only out beyond the Tion cluster. I'm one of your hosts, Jedi Master John Mills, and with me, as always, is my very good friend, Jedi Master Matthew Rushing. Matt, how are you today?
I'm doing great. I gotta say, I love wild space. It's so nice out here. None of the clogged, yeah. Space lanes. I mean, you can just pretty much go wherever you want. It's wonderful out here.
Yeah, and now I'm thinking maybe at some point in the future we will have to talk about, is it possible to have traffic jams in hyperspace? And what would that look like? But for now, I would offer that Rebels has started back up. We've had our discussions about Rebels before and pros and cons and back and forth with it. But one of the elements that they have carried forward that we're both somewhat fascinated by is the Darksaber.
Yes.
Our first encounter with the Darksaber was back in the Clone Wars. And then it was brought forward here to the Rebels series. And it's a means by which to tie Sabine Wren into the larger Mandalorian narrative that we're familiar with. So, looking at the Darksaber, I would venture a guess as to say that it is one of those very interesting elements that is it's a heck of a plot device to move stories along. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to look at it from the lens of other swords that we've seen in legendary tales and, sort of like a compare-contrast sort of situation. So, Matt, if anybody is unfamiliar with, if you're unfamiliar with the Darksaber and listening to Aggressive Negotiations, bless your heart.
Well, isn't that special?
Right. But, Matt, why don't we give a rundown for the Darksaber? What is it?
One of the coolest things, and I have to say, that Rebels did was really add to the lore of the Darksaber and finally give us its background and what makes it so unique. In that the first Mandalorian that was introduced into the Jedi Order, inducted into the Jedi Order, very, very long time ago, before the Battle of Yavin. It's like, I'm trying to remember, it's like over a thousand years before.
Right, it's basically like Star Wars prehistory.
Yeah, exactly. It's like Star Wars Middle Earth.
That's a good way to put it.
So, one of the Vizslas, it's Tar Vizsla, I believe is how you say it, created this saber, and it was his lightsaber that he carried, and which one is fascinating because I think it adds so many questions about saber technology back in the day. Is this the only saber we have lying around from this time period? Is what they all looked like? Kyber crystals, colors. But we're not going to get into that today. Maybe another episode we might dive into that. Yeah.
That's a great question because the Darksaber essentially is blackish. Like there's an energy current that flows through it. But if mm-hmm. your kyber crystal is reflecting your state of being, wouldn't people have panicked a little bit if somebody turned one on and it's black? Like this glowing
son
black.
Of a, yeah.
Right. Huh. Your onyx blade does not fill me with confidence that you are heroic.
No. And it's interesting, this like Stygian blade, the idea of that is very interesting. But I mean, it creates this mystique around this specific lightsaber because once Vizsla passes, the next members of House Vizsla, they broke into the Jedi Temple and they stole the saber. And they used that to unite Mandalore, and it was passed down from generation to generation. So in some ways, it kind of became this Mandalorian Excalibur,
right.
A sword with which the the power of the people was invested in. And so I think that's, to me, was something that was really fascinating, because also pulling from everything, especially just rewatching those recent Rebels episodes, the Mandalorians are becoming more and more the Klingons of the Star Wars galaxy to me, because it's all about these families, these houses, this honor. I mean, it's very similar to me. But
I agree.
It was very interesting because the sort of Kahless in Star Trek Deep Space Nine was also the thing that Worf and Jadzia and Kang went looking for as well. So it was so fascinating to me to see them kind of tie all this stuff together in Rebels with this Darksaber that has this history. And not only on top of that, but the story element that they use to tell the story of this Vizsla clan and this Darksaber was phenomenal. I mean, it's just, it was wonderful. So that's kind of a very short summation of where this saber comes from.
And what's interesting to me is, especially as they've gone into the history and you have it fall into Sabine, who is one of the main characters of Rebels, as it falls into her hands and she becomes a custodian of it, not to become the next ruler of Mandalore, but to safeguard this symbol and, you know, help find the right person to possess it. There are, first and foremost, with the history of it, and then seeing an echo of that in Anakin's/Luke's saber in the episode movies, with Rey taking that back to Luke, there's an echo there. And I couldn't help but think in the latest episode of Rebels, as we've recorded this, there will be others by the time maybe somebody's listening to this down the road. But the episode that we just saw has Sabine get back to Mandalore, encounter her family, encounter the Imperial governor of Mandalore, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the Darksaber is at the center of all of this. And what's fascinating to me is I almost wondered if I was seeing an echo or a hint about Rey's place in terms of bringing Luke's saber back to him. A hint, because Sabine is, you know, Mandalorian, and she is part of this great saga, but the more quote-unquote important thing is what the saber represents. And I wonder if there is a hint in Sabine's relationship to the saber for Rey's, like a hint that Rey might not be a Skywalker as we understand the line. Like, she might be related to the Skywalkers. She might be of the line of Skywalker, but she is not a direct descendant of the ones that we've encountered up to this point. Because that's how I see Sabine with this saber, and I just wonder if there's an echo there. There's a hint that they're giving us for the coming story in the episode movies.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea, and I hadn't thought about it until you said something, but it does make a lot of sense that, and in some ways, the stories do mirror each other. You know, she has the saber, Sabine does, but she doesn't want the power that comes with it. She doesn't want to be the ruler of Mandalore, and she's realized that she should not be the ruler of Mandalore, but she will find the one who should be, which, hint, hint, is probably going to be Bo-Katan. Thank God she's coming back. because Dave even said that she was. And mentioned earlier, too, that historically, for the Clone Wars, once Maul was taken down, which we read about in the Ahsoka novel, Bo-Katan was actually the leader for a while of all of Mandalore, which is fascinating. It just makes me want a whole, I just want more books about Mandalore, because it's become a much more interesting, for me, place than, and God forbid, I know I'm going to get hate mail, so just send it to us over at thenerdparty.com/contact, choose, aggressive negotiations. I never got into the Karen Travis stuff, those novels, but this stuff to me is fascinating.
Oh, the Karen Travis novels were good. I liked them, and I actually see sort of an echo of the treatment of the honor family idea.
Right.
And the houses and clans in this. What's interesting to me is that the history of the Mandalorians is so much more intricate and so much more interesting than what we were even given a hint of before. And yeah, by that, definitely. I mean that Boba Fett rises to fame. We know Mandalorian armor, and you know he obviously makes an impact on the fan base and all of those sorts of things. And you know, and we've talked about Mandalorians here on the show before, but what we're getting is this incredibly intricate history of this, you know, of these people, of this planet, of all of these things. And it's so fascinating, specifically because the reason that I don't always fall in love with expanded universe books or efforts, you know, both in the past and today, is there what the intricacy is. You made a reference to Tolkien before.
Mm-hmm.
Is very Tolkien-esque.
Yeah.
This sense that every little bit that you're seeing, like, you know, you go into Mandalorian history and it gives you the sense to carry forward when you encounter another planet. Even if you don't get that treatment, it instantly spurs your imagination to say, well, obviously they have a story too, and what is that? And so it's one of those things where it fills in all of these gaps over here, and by that it spurs you on to fill in the rest of the story over there. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think what you're saying too is that the way that they're doing this stuff with the Mandalorians is creating more questions, in the sense that it's like, I want like Mandalorian thrones. Like, forget Game of Thrones. I want Mandalorian thrones.
I'd be down with that.
I mean, couldn't you just imagine a really awesome like PG-13 series for adults, like a live action series,
right?
It's more for adults, that's about this power struggle for Mandalore in, you know, from the time of Maul leaving to, you know, what happens. Like, it'd just be fascinating.
Right. It would be fascinating, and even more fascinating on top of that is I think that the Mandalorians are a great race to examine things with anyway, because they are given this sense of separateness from the rest of the galaxy. There is this immense sense of pride and identity that enables them, like in all of these episodes that we've gotten, even post-Empire, is there are those who collaborate with the Empire, but they are hated. They are excluded. They are collaborators. And those who are Mandalorian really reflect this idea that, yeah, we've encountered a rebellion and everything like that, but this is a real specific racial identity sort of storyline in Star Wars that is so specific that, it makes it anomalous. It makes it feel wonderful and epic and separate at the same time, but belonging,
right?
You know?
Well, and I think one of the things that makes it so interesting is just that this whole thing with the Darksaber and the way that it's kind of connecting. I mean, you think of, when, again, we mentioned Tolkien with, and we talked about Excalibur, obviously, but, you know, you have Andril, Flame of the West, the reformed
right.
shards of Narsil, and in a lot of ways that this is very similar to that. And it's so interesting to see the ways in which Dave Filoni, I think specifically, is having this influence, because you know Dave loves Tolkien.
Right.
He's already talked about the influences that's had on the Ahsoka arc, and
right.
where she's been and who she might be when she comes back. Hint, hint, Gandalf the White, which we already got a hint of with her lightsabers, I think. But the whole idea that they're also bringing that kind of medieval folklore sensibility into the Mandalorians makes so much sense, and
it does.
Really fits.
It does. It fits really well. But while we're sitting here talking about the folklore and the Darksaber, there's a part of me that is, now that the Darksaber is back out in the open, as it were, now that it's there, now that it's going to be known that the Darksaber is back in play for Mandalore, I'm not trying to project into future storylines, but do you think that they back off of the Darksaber for, I mean, for me, because I look at something like the Darksaber and it becomes one of those plot elements where this is a thing that can unite the people. This is a thing that becomes so important that the Empire, specifically Palpatine, would say, oh, it's back. All right, we got to get our hands on that. Vader or Inquisitors or whomever, go on out and take care of that for me and give it to the next governor that I appoint, and end of scene.
I think this is going to be a very interesting question, and I think you rightly raise it, because you know, if Mandalorian can get its ass together, which the Mandos want to, you know, her Ursa Ren, Sabine's right. mother even says that we need to get our stuff together before we can help the rebellion. And right. she seems very eager to be able to do that. But first, she knows that they need to get their own house in order, and they need to do that themselves. That's the Mandalorian way. And I think you're absolutely right in calling out that if they start to do that, if there seems to be a way to unite the people, does Palpatine have an issue with that? Now, it also raises another interesting question from, you know, the two episodes that just came out with Rebels, where as Kanan is training Sabine with the Darksaber, and she's using some of her Mando gadgets, and he puts her in her place, and he says, after she's tried a few of the tricks on him, you realize that the Jedi won. They defeated the Mandalorians. And so all of these tricks may save your life maybe once in a while, but it's not going to replace training and discipline. And right. that's an interesting thing, too, because do the Mandos have enough training? Will they have enough discipline to do what needs to be done to unite their people? Or will they continue to devolve into the selfish lifestyle that they've had, which is we're just trying to stay alive instead of, like, you know, right. You know what I'm saying? Like
I do.
What's his name? Gar Saxon was, you know, he
right.
appointed the Emperor's hand over Mandalore. Hint, the Emperor's hand. That's fun to have that back.
Right.
But let's not go into that. Sorry.
But there is also, is there a subtextual connotation maybe that can carry forward to, you know, episodes 8 and 9 or whatever we get going forward, to this idea that there's too much assigned to the relics? Because we know we've had Bloodline, where there are people who are collecting Imperial relics. We know that the Emperor collected relics, Sith relics. We know that the First Order, the Knights of Ren at least, are obsessed with relics. We know that that the Mandalorians are obsessed with this specific relic. Is there a common thread, maybe even an unintentional subtextual message, that the Mandalorians can unite? They don't need a relic to do this. You don't need a saber to go get Luke. You don't need these things, but we rely on them. And so is there a commentary there about the importance we assign to things when what's really driving us forward is our own spirit?
That's another well-formed question, and I think it's twofold. So I think the relics are important because they remind us of the history. But what has happened with so many people with the relics is they get mired in trying to recreate history instead of moving forward. You see what I'm saying? And I think
exactly.
That's what happened with maybe Luke, even in episode 7 before then.
And we know what happened with the First Order.
Right.
They were obsessed
exactly.
with simply recreating the past.
In many ways, yes. I mean, their goal was to create an even maybe purer form of the Empire.
Right.
And look how well that has turned out for them. No, and I think you're absolutely right, because that and I think that's going to be fascinating, because does Mandalore find a way during the civil war that the rebellion has to maybe stay out of it, and that do they come into play maybe? I mean, do they become a piece in the puzzle because they finally got their stuff together by
right.
the 40 years from the rebellion to the
sure.
you know, after Force Awakens, that they become somebody who's helpful against the First Order for the fledgling, you know, half destroyed New Republic.
I think that's a great thought. I think stuff like that could easily come into play, and I think also that the separate identity of the Mandalorians and the way that the story shakes out, I think for, you know, ancient fans like myself, is really nice, because I remember all the way back to the Brian Daley books, this idea of the, you know, the corporate sector. And then we get, you know, the Star Wars galaxy for the casual fan, I think, never quite jibed with the way that Lucas himself envisioned the way that things were. And that's why, you know, the first real mention we get of it on screen is Cloud City. You know, we're small enough to avoid the Empire's notice, but it's really explored in The Phantom Menace with the State of the Republic. This is Hutt space. This is Federation space.
Right.
This is Republic space. And I think we see with the Mandalorians a hint that that very much continued through the Empire. It was simply that the hand of the Emperor was sterner and different, and he put more direct fingers into the pies, but it's still a fractured galaxy.
Tarkin even says that now the regional governors will have direct control.
Right.
You know, and so those governors, which Gar Saxon was over the Mandalorian sector, because the planet that they're even on in the Rebels episode isn't Mandalore, it's
right.
Cronus, which very similar again.
Wink, wink, nudge,
Star
nudge.
Trek, yeah, with Cronos. But no, I love that though, because it you're absolutely right. The way in which the Empire has a firm grasp on everybody who's in control of those areas, and then those areas are under the control of and the threat of Vader basically showing up at your doorstep, telling you did something, well, choking you as they tells you did something wrong.
Right.
You know, he doesn't want anybody choking on their ambitions. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, I actually also think it's very interesting because you see, I think the struggles of the Empire, like I'm starting to appreciate the story from the vantage point that the Empire is on the verge of becoming the monolithic domineering entity that Palpatine wants it to be when it's taken down. It never quite gets to what he's going toward. I very much get that feeling because the imposition of the bureaucratic hand never true. You know, Mandalore is able to retain identity. Even Tatooine retains identity. All of these different localities. So that even gets back to Princess Leia's line in the original Star Wars. The more you tighten your grip, Tarkin, the more star systems will slip through your fingers. I think Mandalore speaks to that point, too.
Well, and it makes your point about what happens with this Darksaber rising
right.
You know, back on Mandalore, and what implication is that going to have? You know, now that Sabine has it, that she's going to be searching for the person to wield it. And this is the interesting thing, too. You know, Ursa Wren also says, you know, anybody can hold the Darksaber. The trick is keeping it along with your head, as she says, which I really liked. You know, and so that this is something that if you have people start going after you, it's almost like in any of the mob movies, you know, the moment you become the Godfather, you're the one who everybody wants to take down, you know. The moment you hold the Darksaber, you're the one that everybody wants to take out. Or, I mean, honestly, this is exactly like Harry Potter with the Elder Wand. If you have the Elder Wand, everybody wants it, and they come after you. I mean, that's the story that they're telling, you know. And so it's a dangerous thing to have in your possession, and also be the person who's trying to unite. And so I think what they've created here is a really wonderful opportunity in season 4 of Rebels, because I don't think we're going to be getting any more of the Mandalorians to maybe finish out this story.
Do you think we're going to get a season 4? I know that this isn't necessarily a Darksaber sort of thing, but I have to ask. There are some rumblings. There are some hints that there are new projects coming up. Do you think we're going to get a season 4? Because this right now, the Darksaber arc feels as tied up in a bow as any extended Star Wars arc can feel. And Sabine's arc feels as tied up as any extended Star Wars arc can feel. Do you think that we will return to the Darksaber? Do you think we will Do you think we're seeing the sun setting right now?
No, I do think that we are going to see a season four of Rebels. Dave all but confirmed that in an interview, saying that the announcement should be coming any day now. And part of that to say they work so far ahead with these episodes.
Sure. Well, I mean, when Clone Wars got canceled suddenly, look at how many arcs were they were basically in. You know, you can go on YouTube and you can actually watch completed arcs.
Right.
Right there. It's just that the animation isn't as nice as you would like it to be.
Right. Exactly. And so, no, I do think that it will definitely be back. And I think that this will be a storyline for that season, as they're also building the storyline to get the crew basically to where we were in Rogue One and give their story. And right. I do think season four is the end. But what I'm so excited about is the way in which the Darksaber has been such a link between such an early concept in the Clone Wars, you know, from season two with that whole temptation arc for Obi-Wan.
still one of the best arcs that they've ever had. And
and it was fantastic when, you know, Pre Vizsla pulls out that Darksaber to challenge Obi-Wan, and you're just like, what the heck is that?
There is not a single Star Wars fan that was watching that show that saw the Darksaber ignite and didn't say some variation of, oh, cool. Like that was, I remember watching that alone in my basement and just sitting there, you know, with my beverage of choice and some Twizzlers. It's like, it's Clone Wars night. And then Pre Vizsla pulls out the Darksaber. And just seeing it and saying, huh, that's, wow, that's cool, man. And just obsessing over it. Obsessing over it to the point where I can say that of all of the lightsabers that we've talked about, we had a whole show where we talked about lightsabers, our back and forth about kyber crystals and the evolving, you know, storylines with those and what they can do and what they mean. I do have a friend where his favorite saber to this day is the Darksaber. And I got to say, it is a huge blind spot for me because that does belong in the conversation of coolest sabers ever made.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think the thing that was so neat about it is the reason that it became a lightsaber as well. You know, when George and Dave were talking about that, it was going to be a vibroblade. And George is like, no, lightsabers need to be special, and vibroblades should not be able to block a lightsaber. It would cut them in half. And so they turned it into a lightsaber and created this thing, which, you know, I don't think they necessarily had all of this planned out at the beginning. But the fact that that this is some form of an ancient lightsaber, it's one of those things like, what they gave us in the Rebels episodes as a background is almost enough. I almost don't want to know any more about it because the mystery surrounding it is just, it's better than anything else almost that I feel like that they create.
Right. I think that the amount of history that they've given us is just enough for us to wonder. Like, I enjoy the type of stuff where, and this isn't taking anything away from the people that work on the shows who are brilliantly talented and incredibly creative. I'm thinking in terms of there are certain things where it was nicer to have, you know, some fuzziness with it so that you could play with your own headcanon, as we like to call it. And what's funny is I think the best example of that for a long time until the prequels came up and fixed the situation was Boba Fett. You know, speaking of Mandalorians and Mandalorian armor and everything, the backstory that they gave Boba Fett in the expanded universe until the prequels was really not good. It was really something where I remember reading it where they made a concerted effort to turn him into sort of an anti-hero, somebody who was simply very dedicated to justice. And, you know, Journeyman Protectorate Jaster Mareel, that phrase still sends shivers down my spine. And, you know, the whole reason I bring it up is that Lucas had to come in with the prequels and basically, you know, from my vantage point, fix things and give Boba Fett a truly great backstory an origin point. The Darksaber right now has all of that greatness to it, and I'm on your side. I'm like, I'm good. I don't need more than that. That's interesting.
It's one of those things too, you know, where George, he, with Boba Fett and all of that, the mystique that came around Boba Fett wasn't anything that he had planned. For him, Boba Fett was always kind of just a thug, you know, with armor.
Right.
Because cool, he's not a cool Mandalorian. You know, he just ends up with that armor. Jango steals that armor. So,
well, wait a minute. Is Fett in the same armor as Jango? I always envisioned it that it was like the ship of, I think it's the philosophical question is the ship of Theseus, mm-hmm. where there might be a tiny component of it that's the same, but it's largely been modified and replaced over time.
Yeah, I always figured that part of that armor is his dad's and part of it's his. And
right.
You know, I mean, because I always guessed, you know, he after episode two, I mean, he doesn't, and we see in the Clone Wars, he's not wearing that armor yet. One, right. He couldn't fit in it anyway. He's still a boy. But that he's saving that armor somewhere until he can fit in it, you know. And he slowly, as he grows, kind of adds certain pieces and then creates his own and, now, you know, all that stuff. So that's kind of my headcanon of where Boba Fett went. Of course, I know from our favorite books, the Aftermath books, that armor ends up spat out of the
I don't remember. The Aftermath, I read the first two Aftermath books, and it's sort of like a bad date. You know, I remember that I went on it, but I'm assiduously trying to forget the details. So I'm good. But you know, I think that the Darksaber is a wonderful thing. I'm glad that they brought it forward, tied Rebels to Clone Wars with it. And, it, you know, like I said, it's one of my friend's favorite sabers. I think it's definitely in the conversation. We invite anybody who's listening to, like Matt said earlier, drop a line at thenerdparty.com/contact. Let us know your thoughts on the Darksaber. You know, are they hitting the right notes with you? Is there something about it that rings true, rings hollow, anything like that? Go ahead and reach out to us there. You can reach out to us on Twitter, @TheJediMasters. That's the show account. And you can reach out to us through the network Twitter account, @JoinNerdParty. And, of course, you can go to Facebook and reach out to us at facebook.com/TheNerdParty.
And you know what else they can do, John?
What's that?
They can give us a review like we got on iTunes from YGY Mom CEO. And she said this, you're going to love this. It's the title of the review, Off Beaten Path, 5 stars. And she says, let's face it. You can find Star Wars analysis all over the web. You can hardly put Star Wars into a podcast search field and not trip over a gazillion entries, like stepping on Legos scattered around the upstairs hallway in the middle of the night in your bathrobe and your way to the loo. What makes this one unique is that the creators take time to think up unusual and off-beaten topics to give them the treatment and airtime they deserve. Aggressive Negotiations is the random Lego that didn't hurt. Well done.
That is one heck of a review, and
yes,
very much appreciated. As Matt and I like to say, we're not doing this for money. We're doing this for the love of the game. And reviews like that make us really, really, I mean, that's really touching.
We got compared to Legos. I'm just excited. I want my own minifigure.
You know, I would say that the description of stepping on Legos sounds like it's from personal experience with how much detail there was there.
I remember doing it as a kid because I'd have them all over my room and I'd step on them at night. But okay, before we get off topic, because I could go on Lego all night, John.
Sure.
Where can everybody find you online? I mean, you know, we've brought up some interesting topics, and if they want to talk to you about those, where can they find you?
You can find me at Kessel Junkie on Twitter, where I am continuing my watch on what I suppose is going to be the release of the original Star Wars movies on Blu-ray this year. We'll see. Who knows? And you can also find me over here on the network, actually, co-hosting Great Shot Kid with Mike Schindler, where we explore the non-Star Wars works of Star Wars creators. We're going to be looking at more American Graffiti soon, and it's going to be interesting because Mike hasn't seen that before, and that's a doozy. You can also find me co-hosting Words with Nerds with my pal Craig, and you can find me over on Trek FM also with Mike, co-hosting Stage 9, where we explore the non-Trek works of Star Trek creators. Now, that is my corporate sector section of the internet and podcasting galaxy out there, Matt. Why don't you tell people where they can find you?
Well, you can find me over here on the Midrim Worlds. I'm on Twitter at MattRushing02. You can also find me doing The Orb with Chris Jones over there on Trek FM. We're talking about Deep Space Nine on that show. Also doing the 602 Club, the General Geek Show. It's so much fun. We are covering every fandom we can possible. Just recently talked about the 1980 cult classic Flash Gordon with my good friend Champion.
Roll back the word classic.
Well, you'll listen to the episode and see if we come up with that conclusion.
I can't wait.
You can find that show, the 602 Club, as well as Star Wars, the 602 Club Collection. All of those are on iTunes. And then I'm also here on the network, the Nerd Party Network, that is, with Drea Kaufman. We're talking about Harry Potter, walking through every chapter of Harry Potter. It's been a blast so far. We're about midway through the first book now. That's Owl Post, and of course you can find that on the website as well as iTunes. So I hope you will give that a listen. But John, I think there's only one thing left to say. I think it's time to close negotiations.
Matt, negotiations are closed.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.